make it through every team in the National Hockey League. But we're going to address as many situations as we can. Kevin Paul DuPont, Eric Tkachuk will join yours truly and John Shannon here. And we'll address some of the more interesting stories over the first, 10 days or so of the regular season.
Yeah, there are some very interesting trends and tendencies, Bob. And here's the thing. A team can't win a division or a playoff spot in the first 2 or 3 weeks or a month, but they sure as heck can play themselves out of one. And that's what we're looking at, I think, for a couple teams already.
Well, we're going to address them. And they're both original six teams, too, interestingly enough. KP DuPont, Eric Tkachuk, and we come back after these messages. Well, the Hockey Pucks have gathered. It's McCowan, it's Shannon. Well, not that I'm a Hockey Puck by any stretch of the imagination, but the other...
You are certainly becoming a Hockey Puck, Mr.
Honorary. Honorary.
Yeah, I'm the anti-hockey puck is what I am. Kevin Paul DuPont is not where he's supposed to be. He's with the Boston Globe, but I hear you're in Buffalo. Is that right?
I am, but I'm still with the Boston Globe as well. Yes.
Good to
know. At least as of this morning.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Well, you know the way things are in the media biz.
Could be.
Every 5 minutes, you better check. Eric Tkachuk is not in Alberta. He's in Southern California. He's with the Athletic last time he looked, too. Still there?
Still there, yeah. Going pretty well, actually. Keeping fingers crossed. Going to jinx it.
That was quite the expression after going pretty well, Eric.
Every 5 minutes, take a look.
Two print guys with real confidence here. Yes. Well,
you're talking to a couple of guys who have been disposed of their position in the media, which is why we're doing this crap.
It's an ugly world.
Kevin and I on because both of us started in an era when you actually wrote on typewriters. Kevin, I didn't even start on an electric typewriter. I had an Underwood. The first newsroom I ever walked into in 1978, full time, it looked like a scene out of the Front Page. Honestly, you know, like if Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon had appeared at the news editor's desk, I wouldn't have been surprised. So that was a long time ago.
Yeah, there was a gal on the beat, and I'm sorry to say now, I can't remember her name, but she was posting yesterday that she wanted to use her laptop on the airplane. And of course, you only get, 6 inches to drop your laptop in. She politely asked the guy in front of her if he could push his seat forward so she could type. He declined. So he was a jerk, but it took me back almost 50 years when I was on an Amtrak. And I had my portable Royal and all the paper and all the carbon paper with me. And got admonished by the woman in front of me, and rightly so, that I was hitting the keys too hard and making the whole chair rattle. You know, we have our touch, right? Even now with my laptop, I hammer away far too hard. But part of that is because the only way you could do it was you had to hit those keys really hard.
Yeah, sure you did.
Yeah. Congratulations for both of you. There are people that are listening to the podcast now are Googling Underwood, Royal, Walter Matthau, and Jack Lemmon. So congratulations.
Yeah, let's give them whiteout too. They can give that a try.
Mm-hmm. I'm on carbon paper. I haven't heard anyone mention that in 50 years either. So,
that was like money in the bank. If you could have 6 clean sheets of carbon paper, tucked away in your bag just as the backup.
We are drawing in a new audience with this conversation.
Well, no, we're losing all of the existing audience out of the two.
Yeah, but retirement homes are just tuning in by the groves right now.
Yeah, be careful, there's a bunch of people that's sitting around this this podcast here that are really close to a retirement home.
Well, that's where you're doing it from, right?
Yeah, bite me. So yeah, so 81, I go to Global Television, and I'm typing on an Underwood, you know, a regular Underwood, the typewriter. And then in the mid-80s, like 84, 85, I'm doing a column for I can't remember whether it was the Star or the Sun, because I did a bit for both. And it was a computer thing, but it was a machine that they gave you. What the hell was that thing called? And you pressed a button and it sent it transmitted.
Fax machine?
No, it wasn't a fax machine. It was like a typewriter.
Right.
But it was in a box. It was a separate unit. What the hell was that thing called? You guys must have used those things when you were on the road. I think you
probably also had it that if you wanted to transmit the story, you actually took the telephone and put the
yeah
into the
receiver in the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you got that AOL kind of connection thing.
I can tell you, we called them the bubble, but I don't know if I don't know the manufacturer. Do you remember that one, Hat? The bubbles?
No. I remember those acoustic couplers and how inconsistent they were and how on deadline they could drive you crazy in a noisy building. And I know the machine you're thinking of, but I don't remember the brand. And we never used that. We went right past that straight to the Radio Shack. So that was one of the better the things about being at the Calgary Herald in the early 80s. They were cutting edge.
The Commodore 64, never been the same.
Hey, I had one of those. And then upgraded to the Commodore 128, which I thought, well, this is the ultimate machine.
The one we lugged for years and years was they called it the Trash 80, TRS 80, which was a Radio Shack unit. Of course, Radio Shack's gone now too. But
well, yeah,
that was the one. And they, just as Hat just said, you had the telephone couplers with it. But that thing was indestructible. You could drop that off a cliff and it would still work for you. So that was great.
All right. So now that we've lost the audience, we can talk freely.
Yeah, swear all we want. Yeah.
Well, there's lots of interesting stuff going on here. We're like, a couple of weeks into the NHL season, not even. And Habs can't beat anybody. They'd lose an intra-squad game, it looks like, right now. I'm not personally shocked. I thought last year was a complete and total mirage. And no, they don't have Carey Price. And that's part of this. But these guys can't put a biscuit in the basket. Are either of you really surprised at the Montreal Canadiens? I mean, 0-5 is a bit much, but they're not that good, are they? Hat?
Well, I would say that they're a team that's in that mushy middle. And so one of my favorite lines from Kevin was when he talked about the Hartford Whalers as the forever 500. And it's always been stuck in my brain because I think that with parity in the National Hockey League, there's about 2/3 of the league that are the forever 500s. They're good enough to win, 50% of the games, and they're bad enough to lose 50% of the games. And I would put Montreal in that exact group. And Bob, you're 100% right. If you just look at their regular season last year, they were a decent NHL team, just like there's 15 to 18 other decent NHL teams. And if things just navigate the right way for you, and if it happens to be your week, it could be your year. And that's what happened with Montreal last year. I wasn't sold on their talent. I always look at forwards 1 to 12. Who's their top player? And then what's really telling is who's their fourth best player. So now your brain starts to rattle around. They have a good team, not a great team. And to your point, Carey Price's absence and also Shea Weber. I mean, he's someone that sure, for all of the issues that he may have had physically, he was such a dominant personality in that dressing room. And often, when it can tilt this way or that way in any game, having someone like Weber to rally the troops, having someone like Carey Price to make one more stop, one more save. That's really all. That's the difference between an elite level goaltender and a very average goaltender. You subtract those two guys from the mix, you figure the difficulty of coming back after a long run where you're unsuccessful. People always talk about the Stanley Cup hangover. To me, the hangover is always associated with the team that loses the Stanley Cup final, because at least the team that wins the Stanley Cup final has a literal hangover. I think the team that loses the Stanley Cup final, it's literal and figurative as well. It's just hard to come back after going so deep into the playoffs, knowing you're starting from scratch and you came that close and failed to close the deal.
That's an interesting notation. Does anybody have any statistics on that or any recollections of teams that have lost Stanley Cup finals and then had a terrible following year?
Tampa. 2015, Tampa went to the Stanley Cup final game 6. Next year, didn't make the playoffs.
That's right. That's right.
there are a few examples. I Eric and Kevin, you can jump in here. I think Eric's being really nice to Montreal. He's always been a cup half full guy anyway, because I don't think they're good at all.
No, I don't.
It's not just those two, not just Price and Weber, but arguably their best forward consistently for the playoffs last year is now playing in Los Angeles and Philip Deneau. They lost, the whole Kakimeni drama in the summertime was a distraction. I just don't see anywhere on the ice right now that they have a strength. They have no strength. And when you said, look at your fourth forward, God, I was trying to think their fourth forward. I'm not sure who, give me a name. I'm not sure who that is. What do you think, Kevin? You've watched, as a Bruin follower, I know you revel in the fact that Montreal is wallowing. I mean, what do you see?
I was going to say, being from Boston, the jury's a bit biased anyway, but right. You bring up Kotkaniemi and he's really kind of the least of it, isn't he? I mean, in terms of what it is. So I always try to look at what is the spine of your team, right? It's the spine of a true contender is going to have an elite center, an elite defenseman, and ideally an elite goaltender. Well, you could make the case that last year they at least had the elite defenseman in Weber and the elite goaltender in Price. I think the forward group was spotty then. You're right, Dano being the best. And right now, they're 0-3 on the scale of what is the spine of your team. So yeah. Frankly, I think again, going back to Eric and the Forever 500s, typically out of five games, somehow you'll at least squeeze out 3 points, a win and an overtime loss. So I am surprised that they're standing 0-5-0, but it's certainly not a shock by any means, just because caliber of talent, what's in the pipeline. It's not like they've got a kid that they're right on the cusp or, some kid, you can make that case now with 32 teams. If you're good enough to be on the verge or the hot kid in the American League, you're there now. that's just the truth of 32 teams trying to put up 20 good players a night. But right now that is one hot mess in Montreal. And I don't see that there's an easy way out of for them.
Four goals in five games too. Four goals in five games.
Can't score. So even if Carey Price does come back, what does that say? He's got to, spin a shutout every night.
Yeah.
Well, we talk about this all the time in a variety of sports you want to get hot at the right time. And the time to get hot is when the playoffs roll around. And clearly Montreal got hot and confident are almost synonymous in my mind. And they just got confident that mm-hmm. somehow they could do it. And they did all the way to the final. But it really, I never thought it was a reflection of how talented the team was and what the future was going to be. And, I don't think any of us would have anticipated 0-5, but it's just not that good.
But they're, and it's more than just Weber and Price, Bob. Edmondson hasn't played a game yet. He had a really strong playoff because we're not talking about, and Eric brought this up a little bit, we're not talking about Montreal of the 56 game schedule. Our memories are of Montreal who beat Toronto, swept Winnipeg, and then upset Vegas. And so there's no Edmondson, there's no Byron. There's a lot more than just no Weber and Price. And that's the issue, is that, and no Corey Perry, in all of this. And there just doesn't seem to be too much there right now. And that's the thing I think
we all agree with that.
And even getting those guys back isn't going to improve their offense.
Right? No, you know what? I mean, obviously, what Mark Bergeron said the other day is right up to a point. It has to come from within. So you look at the good players that are not playing well. Nick Suzuki looked like he was on the rise, hasn't had a great start. Cole Caulfield, I think most people had him and Trevor Zegras as the two main candidates for Rookie of the Year. Very slow off the market. Last time I checked, Brendan Gallagher didn't have a point. Josh Anderson, you remember how great a start he had in his first game for Montreal last mm-hmm. year? He came in and he was going to be that power forward, that presence. He had an up and down year, but he was an important contributor in the playoffs. He's had issues. Last time I checked, I think Jonathan Drouin was the only player on the team that had more than a single goal. So that's a nice, happy story that he seems to be back on track. But they've got to get collectively more from that group, and they can get collectively more from that group. So, this isn't going to go on indefinitely, but it doesn't change the salient point that you raised, Bob, in your question. How good are they? Very average, I think.
Well, another team that's in a similar scenario are the Chicago Blackhawks. And I don't know whether we should be more surprised by their performance than Montreal's or not, but they're playing crummy right now. Any analysis from you two guys?
Well, I'll be the first to issue a mea culpa here because I really liked the moves that they made. I thought that Marc-Andre Fleury was a massive upgrade in goal. I thought that Seth Jones was a massive upgrade on the blue line. And I thought that Jonathan Toews coming back after missing an entire year, you know, gives you back a one or a 1A center. So all the things that Kevin spoke about the spine of the team. So you look at the remade Chicago Blackhawks. They got the reigning Vezina Trophy winner in goal. They've got a guy that's pre-selected for the American Olympic team. So, you know, that's a great team. And one of three guys, he's a newcomer to your lineup. And Jonathan Toews, just in terms of the presence that he has on and off the ice, I thought those three players added to the lineup, pushing everybody down into the slots that they should be on, I thought they'd be really good. I still think they can be really good. That to me looks as much like a team that just hasn't sort of got in sync yet. You know, when you make those kinds of important changes, a lot of times it changes the leadership balance in a room. You know, guys start to defer to somebody else. So they need to figure out, you know, who the leaders are on the team, what the various roles and responsibilities are on the team. So I do think that there's a greater hope for a turnaround in Chicago than there is in Montreal because they just flat out got better pieces. And it's hard for me to believe that the bottom has fallen out on Marc-Andre Fleury's game. I think Seth Jones could be a lot better than that. And Jonathan Toews, I mean, he missed a year of hockey. It's going to take a little while until he gets back to being Jonathan Toews.
I'd have to say far, far more integrity in that lineup and a far greater chance of recovery. And also that, you know, it's the Central Division. I don't see any powerhouses in that where they can't. They have a better chance of getting it together and creeping up those standings and jumping over places, you know, Arizona chief among them, which you can't even put them in the discussion really. But I think by and large, that is a 500 division, and they can find a way for all those reasons that Hat just pointed out. I think Seth Jones can, well, obviously a lot of people do. They paid him $9.5 million. He can come in and be a true presence back there. I don't see him as the high-end offensive performer that you'd like to have back there. I think, you know, if you make the comparison, say a Charlie McAvoy type that could really sort of mature into that big offensive role. I don't see that for him, but he's in a lineup where he doesn't have to do that. They've got enough integrity among those forwards, and you've got a terrific goal, who should be a terrific goaltender in Fleury. So better stuff there. Far more surprised at their bad start than Montreal's.
Kevin, you think they really they actually could miss Duncan Keith?
Yeah, to a degree. Obviously, I'm not in that room day to day to know what the psychology was around him, especially the psychology of the defensive unit. But why shouldn't they miss him given his experience profile, all of that? And I realize his game isn't nearly what it was even 3 years ago. But, you know, I like him. Why not like him? And certainly when you look at this kind of start, you'd have to say he would have helped.
Meanwhile, KP joins us from Buffalo. And at the beginning of the year, I think we all would have said that there will be a race for last place in the National Hockey League, and Arizona and Buffalo will be the two favorites in that race to finish last. I think you probably have to throw Seattle in there, but nobody seems to agree with me. Maybe you don't even put Buffalo in there right now. That's as shocking a start as I think I can ever recall. I can't imagine they're 3-0, but they are. Anybody care to try and explain that one?
I as you say, I'm here in Buffalo. I'm looking at the roster right now as I peer into my keyboard. You know, this is the opposite of Chicago. I don't see that there's a there with this lineup. But there's
a bunch of guys named who?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, no, at least by my eye, no legit number one goaltender between Anderson and Tokarski. They let old Mark go. He gets his first start here tonight for the Bruins. Remains to be seen if he's truly a number one goaltender, but that's a whole different discussion. No, I just it looks to me like it's first week energy. Go out and skate like hell, guys, and see what happens. And you can win three games. It's been a long time since this team has won three. And it just has the feeling to me not to wish anybody ill will, that we could turn around by this time next month and they've lost eight straight. I don't feel that there's true weight in this lineup.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, one of the things I wrote in my preview was that I thought both Arizona and Buffalo could fool the league for about 3 weeks because everybody's getting sorted out right now. So the good teams are at the bottom and sometimes the bad teams rise to the top. Detroit had a decent start. Like, I don't believe any of these starts for teams that we recognize on paper are below average, are sustainable. But I also think that for a period of time, a couple of things, you know, like a coach rallying the troops like Don Granato in Buffalo, and just the sense of 3 weeks of pounding into them, you know, the NHL world at large is dismissing us. We are professionals here. Let's show them. And I think that carries you for a couple of weeks, possibly even up to a month. But history will tell you that eventually talent will catch up to you. And that's what's going to happen in Buffalo. I do like Craig Anderson as a goalie because no one has been more underrated for a longer period of time than Anderson. He just goes in there and somehow finds a way of helping a team win. And he has been on some terrible teams over the years. And he's just a flat out great pro. And when you think about, you know, the uneven state of NHL goaltending and how stocks can rise and fall, you know, he's someone that just, I think just because he's been at it for so long, he can steady a room with his presence. And so, it is a mirage, I believe, but I think that it's a mirage that could go on for another 7 or 10 days. Eventually it will come to an end, but good for them. Good for them for relying on professionalism and these younger players that are coming in, getting an opportunity to play, you know, more power to them.
Well, I tell you what, they are playing faster. I will tell you that they are playing faster. But Kevin, what do you think? What does this speak of in the Jack Eichel saga? When you think of the team's gone 3-0 without him, there seems to be a positive nature amongst the group. There's no cloud hanging over, and Jack Eichel's at home. What do you think it means?
he is a terrific talent, to state the obvious. Also, I've never heard of a medical case like this in terms of the procedure that he wants, in terms of getting the disc replaced in his neck. And they want to go more to the standard rehab route, if you will, or fusion. So again, I think sports writers, and I'll raise my hand being guilty of this, conjecturing on right or wrong on medical situations is really risky business. But, you know, if they could have a hope here, and it's not going to happen, obviously, that it gets remedied, he gets back here, he steps into a team that's won, let's pick a number, 15 of its first 20 games. Ludicrous as that sounds, that would be a fairy tale. And guess what? It is a fairy tale. I don't see that ever happening here. I think the resolution has to be that he ends up somewhere else. What does it say? In the end, I think just that. I really don't believe this is going to carry through, and we'll look back and say, you know what? They're somewhere around 500, or they're 3 or 4 under 500, and Jack Eichel really wouldn't have made that much of a difference with this team.
Look, we are past the
Eric, midpoint. Do you think Jack Eichel's played his last game? You think Eichel's done as a Sabre, and where does he end up?
Yeah, it's just been so acrimonious at this point. And, you know, then you get into finances of him making $10 million a year. They only had 4,000 people in the stands the other night for the game against Vancouver. That's another big factor here. They're at least as presently constituted, with the border closed, and they're not getting their, pick a number, 3,000 fans to come across the border and help fill the stands here. It's got to be, if you know, when they do start to lose a little and there's no kind of emotional wave supplied in the stands, that's going to be even tougher for them.
I'm going to ask a question that I don't know the answer to. I missed it. If there was a resolution, we don't think there's going to be a resolution to the medical variables here, but if there was a resolution and he had a procedure done next week, what kind of timetable would we be looking for, or would he be looking for to come back? Is there a chance he doesn't play at all this year, even if he has the procedure? Or are we talking about 6, 8, 10 weeks with this kind of stuff? Anybody know?
I know there have been timelines set out for each procedure. And frankly, off the top of my head, I can't remember which one takes more. But as I recall the timelines for the for this different procedures, one was a 2 to 3 month return, and the other one was closer to a 6 month return. And of course, if it's a 6 month return, that's essentially the regular season. They're not
a year's gone. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So then it comes down to like, who can afford to trade for Jack Eichel today and not necessarily need him in the lineup, for until October of next year. And so that to me is a team that is rebuilding. So, you know, John, you were asking, you know, who I like. I like Anaheim. And the reason is that, I mean, Anaheim was not going to trade Trevor Zegras or Jamie Drysdale in a Jack Eichel trade, you know, in the same way that Los Angeles was never going to trade Quinton Byfield. Those are untouchable pieces of a rebuild. So, you know, the original ask for Eichel was too high. You know, if you talk to managers around the league, it was like, we're just not prepared to give up sure things for essentially a distressed asset. Now, the price, as I understand it, has come down, and they're no longer asking for those core young pieces from teams around the league. So now it's a negotiation. How much are you prepared to give up? So if you're Anaheim, you know, do you give up, say, Mason McTavish, who's come in and looked real good for them, and then some kind of a conditional future draft choice that is dependent upon how quickly Eichel gets back and how much of an impact that he has, and that's going to be the eventual resolution. At some point, there is going to be a team that is willing to look at his pedigree, look at his age, weigh the risks associated with this thing, and think to themselves, in a best case scenario, if he comes back and plays, we've got somebody that's potentially a franchise player, potentially a generational player. And yes, at a certain point, there are assets that we're prepared to give up to get him. In terms of the recovery, yeah, I've heard the same thing as Kevin. I hate being a doctor, because we don't have the qualification. But I believe if he has to go for the second more invasive procedure, which is the fusion, then that pretty much rules him out for this year. But as I say, there are teams that are in the early stages of a rebuild that are prepared to think big picture thoughts. And so that's why I think it's those teams rather than the teams that need help right now, that need his presence to get them over the top, that need him to be a difference maker, if not today, fairly soon. If a deal gets done, say before Christmas, I think it will be with a team that has the ability to wait and get him completely healthy, however it takes and whatever procedure he ends up having.
This would be, of course, if it was a team that was so powerful that they could go on and win by giving up those assets, right? So I think, frankly, Tampa could do that. I don't think Tampa has any interest, but Tampa is so powerful. We've got such a great lineup. I think that's a team that could say, you know something, he's young enough. We're strong enough. We could even win it by giving up assets and sending him. But the problem with that is they're so good and they've got such great talent. Most of it is on no move. So they're mm-hmm. they're backed in. There's so many conundrums in this situation. I think maybe the only X factor is the fact that he does make $10 million. If Buffalo were to soften on this position, that currently supposedly they're not going to keep any of this money. Well, if they decide that they have to keep some of this money, be it $2 million a year, $3 million a year, onto their own cap, maybe that could kind of open up the market here. But I think if they're going to maintain this posture of not keeping any of Eichel's money on their payroll, it's going nowhere.
Yeah, I think most teams are asking for $2.5 million. That Buffalo retained $2.5 million. They'll pay the $7.5 million. Insurance obviously will cover it for as long as he's on long-term injury reserve. But I think what you're alluding to, Kevin, and I would agree, is that the teams that will ultimately be able to take that money on their books are the teams that have payroll flexibility, and very few of the true contenders have that kind of payroll flexibility going
if
forward.
Any.
So you can move assets to, you know, down the road to get him on the payroll, but it gets way too complicated. There are, probably 8 or 10 teams at the bottom of the cap friendly list that you see on the internet that that would be able to fit Eichel in right now. I think that he will probably end up with one of those teams.
And with, it sounds like it's supposed to be in the Western Conference anyway, right?
Yeah,
that sounds like yeah, they don't want to stay in the East.
Yeah,
the Pagulas have said you can't
if somebody in the East came and blew them out of the water with an offer, obviously you have to take the best offer. But all things being equal, I think they'd like to put them in Calgary, Los Angeles, Anaheim, a team like that for sure.
Yeah. With Kevin Paul DuPont and Eric Dehatchuk, we'll take a quick break and come back more hockey talk after these messages. It's Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon, Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe, Eric Dehatchuk of The Athletic joining us as we just chat a little bit about hockey. You know, at the beginning of the year, I don't recall anybody opining that this was going to be the year of the Edmonton Oilers, the year that they were going to break through and break out. Everybody acknowledges the potential is there. You have to like some of the things that have been done with the roster, but nobody seemed to want to say, all right, they're good enough. They got two of the best players in the game. They've, you know, they've got decent goaltending. They've got a defense. They've got a defensive core that's a lot better. They've got some experience back there. Four games in doesn't mean a damn thing, but they're 4-0. And you know who has got what, John? 11 points in four games?
11 in four games, yeah. He's playing very, very well. Very well right now.
I mean, did we all kind of are we snake bit? Have we seen them not achieve for so long we're afraid to pick them? Or because, boy, they look real, real good here. KP, what do you think?
Yeah, I like the way you've set it up. Exactly how I felt. In some ways, analogous to my picking the San Jose Sharks year after year.
You weren't alone, pal.
Right, to be in the Cup Final year after year, usually wrong. So in this case, I've been saying year after year, boy, with those two guys at the top of the lineup, you know, this is going to happen, right? And it hasn't, for good reason. And you're far closer to it than me. But you know, overall, depth at forward, not thin at defense, but you know, certainly not stout at defense, and you know, adequate in goal. But the two guys at the top of the lineup with that talent, with that speed, in a game designed around speed, I've kept thinking it's going to happen, going to happen, going to happen. And frankly, I felt that going in. You know, I would not predict a 4-0 start, but I guess at some point, you know, the old blind squirrel thing, it's got to happen. So good for them, and good. I think this is sustainable. I think they'll be there, and you know, I'm glad because these is especially McDavid is such a talent.
So if you go back, Bob, and I can probably send you the link. I picked Edmonton to win the Pacific, and I also picked Florida to win the Atlantic. And it was in one of my reader mailbags from a couple or 3 weeks ago. And I remember one of the comments was, you know, Edmonton over Vegas, that's provocative. And I said, you know, I mean, what do you want? Just boring, bland predictions, the same ones that you get from everybody else. So partly it was to be a bit provocative, but partly because, you know, and Kevin will attest to this, eventually these teams that have that great potential make a step forward. I remember talking to our friend Dave Molinari in Pittsburgh when they had Lemieux and they had Jágr and they still weren't very good. It took them a while. I said, the hard part is over. The hard part is getting those great players in there. The easy part, the easier part is filling in the gaps around them. So it doesn't happen overnight, but it does eventually happen. And then I think that is what has happened in Edmonton. You know, I think Darnell Nurse, he never gets talked about or he rarely gets talked about. He took strides last year. Excellent. I like Dave Tippett as a coach because Dave Tippett can manage Tyson Barry's minutes. I mean, you know, Barry's defensive shortcomings are widely recognized. Just have to watch them play. I mean, he is not the most sound defensive defenseman, but he is a brilliant power play quarterback. And the way that power play is, it's sensational again this year. It was sensational last year. And so if you have a coach that understands how to shelter the minutes of a guy like that and get the most out of him, that to me is what Dave Tippett does. He gets the most out of everybody in this lineup. And that goes for the goaltending too, because I think that, you know, Mike Smith is someone that a lot of people have been prepared to write off year after year after year. And he's so competitive and he's so athletic and he moves the puck so well. I mean, yeah, I guess the bottom eventually does fall out on everyone's games, but he was excellent for them last year, and he's been really good until he got hurt at the start of this year. So, I mean, goaltending is a question mark. They were in on Jacob Markstrom a couple of years ago. They were looking at different options, but eventually they ran out of money, and they just decided to press forward with this group. And I think the thing that Ken Holland said about Mike Smith and relying on veteran goaltenders in his time in Detroit, he tried not to look at the birth certificates of the players. He looked at what they were contributing. You know, he brought a too old Dominic Hasek in Detroit. He brought a too old Chris Chelios in there and got valuable years out of these guys. So, you know, I like the way that they think managerial in terms of the way the management thinks there. I like the way the coach approaches it. And when you have talents like McDavid and Draisaitl, eventually it just brings everybody to the surface. And Hyman's helped. Puljujarvi's getting better. It's a pretty good team right now. It's a pretty good team.
The acquisitions in the offseason there, Hyman is certainly an asset. Warren Fogel is an asset. Duncan Keith is an asset. And then something from a homegrown version. Evan Bouchard, there's been a ton of pressure on Evan Bouchard to make the next step. And in this short period of time, it appears that he has made the next step. And that has made this team, when people did have question marks about their blue line, did have question marks about goaltending, and I don't think the question marks of goaltending are going to go away very quickly. But I think the team has three good lines of players now, not a top six, bottom six. I think they have three lines that can put the puck in the net, and their defense is much more complete with three good solid pairs than it was last year.
Well, there was an Edmonton team a few years ago that scored more goals than anybody in history, and won Stanley Cups essentially doing that. And I know we can get into the how good was the goaltending, how good was the defense, but they won because they put the biscuit in the basket.
But that's Bob, the biggest issue in Edmonton is the same issue that exists in Toronto. Is you can have the greatest regular season of all time, but what have you done for me in the playoffs? And the last 2 years in the playoffs, in the bubble, and then the sweep by Winnipeg last year, the Edmonton Oilers were a huge disappointment. And so they're gonna get through the regular season, and they're gonna be entertaining, and we're gonna rave about them, and they're gonna win trophies. And then the question becomes, what have you done on that last week of April when the playoffs start? That's the key question.
Get that, John, you get that with every team. I mean, I don't think that's a unique. That's not something that's unique to the Edmonton Oilers. It is.
No, it's not.
You know, let's talk about the Colorado Avalanche. And you know, the KP, the San Jose Sharks of today. You know, everybody loved the Sharks for the better part of a decade. Picked them over and over again, and well, they just kept falling on their own sword. Well, Colorado has done that essentially. And yet there are a lot of people picking Colorado again this year. And, you know, great regular seasons, lots of front-end talent, and they somehow find a way to screw it up when the playoffs come, you know?
Yeah, typically, though, the screw-up is for a reason. It is by that point, it really isn't overall talent or bad coaching, because if you're going to have a great season – you've got to have the talent. You've got to have the coaching. Often what it comes down to is either poor time management, that you've gassed out the whole group to get there, or that they're injured. You know, and as I'm thinking it through, I really don't know, John, you'd be better at this, how that applies to why the Leafs have failed so many times. Because they truly are kind of the showcase piece of this, in my mind, of get in there, look good, and then it just all falls apart.
Well, I mean, I think we've all seen, and anybody that lives in this country, when we fell in love with the Northern Division for 6 weeks, and then we didn't fall in love with it for the remaining 20 weeks, is the fact that the Maple Leafs played a certain style of hockey that was great for 56 games and then couldn't play playoff hockey, you know, and couldn't, and they've tried to address it. They're trying to be more physical, but you know, they're not as good. They're not as good as the Bruins. They're not as good as Florida. They're not as good as Tampa. And they're still, they're going to be in tight in Toronto. They're going to be, it's going to be tough in Toronto. It may have a good regular season, but they're going to have a difficult time getting out of their own division. What do you think, Eric?
Specifically to Toronto, I'd love to see them be one of the teams that crosses over, because I agree that they, you know, psychologically, just in their heads, how are they going to get by Boston? How are they going to get by Tampa? But if they are one of the teams that makes the playoffs beyond the top three and have a chance to cross over in the Metropolitan, I don't think that path is nearly as difficult, and that might be their best chance moving forward. But I just want to circle back to Colorado, because the one thing about Colorado, like I like to, when I start to do my evaluations at the start of the year, I like to actually stare at a roster and look, because you know I think sometimes you can assume they're so talented, they have this, they have that. And if you stare at Colorado's roster, and especially if you stare at their forwards, you know, it goes back to, you know, my thing, who's their fourth best forward? Who's their fifth best forward? And do they really have that much talent up front? And my answer is no. I mean, you know, to me, you know, that top line of MacKinnon, Landeskog, and Rantanen is fantastic. It probably, you know, rivals the Bruins line that's centered by Bergeron and any line that McDavid is centering for the best in the National Hockey League. You know, no question in my mind, they're great. Who's on the second line? Well, it's Kadri, you know, it's Burakovsky, you know, they're moving, you know, Compher in, and Tyson Jost is in the mix. And it, all of a sudden, you know, like, especially if you're just a casual hockey fan, you know, you might be hard pressed to identify the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th Colorado forwards. And so it gets back to that issue that Bob raised about, you know, winning in the playoffs as opposed to winning in the regular season. It's a lot easier in the playoffs if you have one line that you need to shut down to develop a game plan to shut that line down. And the really good teams, the teams that end up winning, are the ones that, like Tampa this year, if the top line, or last year, if the top line is shut down, all of a sudden there's Blake Coleman or Yanni Gourde or somebody coming from the bottom group that scores that goal when you need it. And then I look at Colorado's lineup and I just wonder, do they have that player? And if they don't have it, can they develop that player? I mean, maybe in time it'll be Alex Newhook. Maybe it'll be some of these younger forwards that they got coming through the system. But right now, I don't see it. So I think that they're a team that, you know, depending on who they draw in the playoffs and what kind of a game plan the opposing coach can come up for, I think there's a way of shutting them down. So I think there are maybe more question marks about Colorado than the other so-called elite teams in the National Hockey League right now.
AP, you were going to say something. You want to jump in?
Yeah, all good points by Eric, of course. The point I was going to add earlier was, because we had started the discussion with the Oilers, that, you know, part of the great thing about that Oiler dynasty was, come playoff time, they did change their game. They were really, really as high flying as they were and scoring all those gobs of goals. And, you know, that was such great eye candy. Truth of the matter was, when it came down to playoff time, they really could button it up. Probably better than any team I've watched of that caliber of an offensive team.
Good point.
To be able to kind of, you know, obviously they weren't changing the way they attacked entirely, but pulled it back a little and really tightened it down.
Took them 4 years to learn it.
Yeah,
took it them did. 4 years to learn it. You know, yep. Those 4 years against the Islanders. You know, it took. They had to witness it, because they thought they could be high flying all the time. And Eric, you saw that as much as we did.
No, 100%. You know, they and it's hard to do that. It's hard to play one way in the regular season and then shift gears in the playoffs. And you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting going into the start of the season in the context of the cross-checking crackdown, and I think this is a conversation I had with Ray Ferraro, and he said, I think it should be a red flag for the National Hockey League when you hear general managers say, we need to build one kind of a team to get us into the playoffs, and we need to build a second kind of a team to win in the playoffs, because that speaks to like a fundamental inconsistency, especially as it relates to the officiating standard, that the game changes. And why do you need two separate teams? The team that you build in the regular season should be one that wins in the playoffs. Often it doesn't. Some of that has to do with just the fact that everything is so ramped up in the playoffs. But the other is that whole issue of, you know, does the officiating standard slip? Do the things that get penalized in the regular season suddenly not get called? And then does that give teams that have a lower common denominator a chance to compete against teams that have more talent? And it will be interesting because the league so has emphasized this cross-checking crackdown. And the last two times that they've emphasized something, which was the slash on the hands and then, of course, the obstruction coming out of the lockout, they stuck with it. So with it this time, we may see that teams that have been beaten up in the playoffs, maybe there's a little bit more open ice, maybe there's a little bit of a greater opportunity for the pure skilled guys to just go out and play.
Boys, Kevin Pauls, you've got a hockey game to watch. I hope you're not alone in the arena, although you may be close to it. Yeah. Although you never know, they're 3-0. Maybe, and Boston's in town. Maybe they put a few extra folks in the building.
I would suspect Friday night they should. Yes.
Yeah, they should.
Border opens November 9th. The border opens, and more people will show.
And Dehachik, you go for a walk on the beach.
It just might do that.
That's all you got?
We're jealous. We don't give a crap, though. Yeah. Thank you, boys. Always a pleasure. We greatly appreciate your participation. Until we talk again, thank you.
Thank you, lads.
Kevin Paul DuPont, Eric Dehachik. We'll come back and wrap it after these messages. Our thanks to Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe, Eric Dehachik of The Athletic for joining us on the program. Well, Shannon, what else have you to
Well, we didn't get a chance to talk about Florida, who are off to a great start. They've won four straight games. That's
not overly shocking. A lot of people like the Florida Panthers at the beginning.
Well, they're the best team in Florida. But I didn't think we'd be saying that. Yeah, well, they've already beaten Tampa. So Joel Quenneville has...
Why would you underrate...
done a masterful job. So
why would you underrate him? I mean, he knows how to win.
Hey, by the way, your Browns won last night.
Browns won last night with a bunch of guys named Who. And maybe you should keep the guys named Who and get rid of the guys that we know. Because I don't think I've ever seen a team as injured as they are. No quarterback. Number one quarterback gone. Number one running attack in the NFL. Both of their running backs gone.
Yeah.
Offensive line wounded. Defensive secondary wounded. And they managed to pull off.
No, they were playing Denver. They had a great start, and Denver's really fallen on hard times already too.
Well, I get that, but they were still 3-3 going in, same as the Browns. So, yeah. Look, I would have bet. It's a good thing I don't bet, because I would have had to bet on Denver and by a bunch.
Really, really.
I don't think there was a chance in hell Cleveland could beat them.
You had no confidence in Case Keenum.
Based on what? Hadn't played a game in,
I know,
2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, okay, he's a veteran quarterback who had some success, but really he was the kind of guy you brought in a quarterback. If the rest of your team was really good and you relied on him not to screw it up, he wasn't going to win you games. You just hoped he wouldn't lose you games. And with no disrespect intended to Keenum, he's a serviceable backup, and maybe he's a good enough backup to not be a backup once this team gets healthy, because the rest of this football team is really good.
But I would actually surmise that, you know, the victory last night, I think that it wouldn't surprise me that they could leave Mayfield on the injured list for another week. Because Keenum was good enough to get a victory. I think Baker Mayfield's, I really think he's an elite quarterback. I think he is.
Not me.
But what?
Not me.
Oh, just a minute. This guy is he's the Messiah in Cleveland.
good quarterback, not an elite quarterback. At least
you don't think he's an elite quarterback.
Not a chance. Not a chance. Healthy earlier in the season, his team around him was healthy, and he lost two of his first five. Now, if you look, I will say this much: if you look at the Browns' schedule, it is a nightmare. I mean, they have almost no soft
touch. Well, because everybody wants them on their schedule too, like the networks want. Yeah.
Well, but I mean,
but let me get this straight: you're not a Mayfield fan.
Well, I'm a fan. I'm just not a believer anymore. I've now gone from believer to show me again. Show me again what you showed me a lot last year. And so far, I haven't seen it. Oh, he's got elite wide receivers.
The way he played in that Chargers game. I mean, he was that wasn't his fault. He can't play defense.
Why? Paying him a lot of money. Play defense too.
All right. Listen, I think they're going to sign him big money. He might be the top paid quarterback in the NFL before it's all over.
Well, no, you know, A, he won't, and B, I wouldn't pay him, but he's going to get paid.
We
got to get out of here. Time is our enemy. You have yourself a nice weekend, Mr. Shannon. And we wish the same to the entire audience, however many are left. And we'll, if the crick don't rise, we'll see you on Monday. Goodbye.